It's supposedly making Britain war-ready, as Keir Starmer put it, but beyond the soundbites, on this podcast we ask, what does the Strategic Defence Review actually say, and what might an alternative approach look like?
This morning, Prime Minister Keir Starmer has been at Govan's shipyard in Scotland, where they're building the Royal Navy's new Type 26 frigates, setting out what he says will be a landmark shift in Britain's deterrence and defence.
The threat we now face is more serious, more immediate, and more unpredictable than at any time since the Cold War.
Welcome to the Another Europe podcast with me, Luke Cooper, and my co-host Zoe Williams. Our guest on today's show is Mary Cowdell, my close colleague at the LSE and a long-time member of the Another Europe is Possible campaign. Mary has written about security and defence issues for decades. Today we get her thoughts on whether the government has really prepared us for a world in crisis. In this podcast, there's no extra time. We decided to release the whole conversation. Usually members of Another Europe is Possible get access to extra material as a benefit of membership. We'd still urge you to join and support our work by going to anothereurope.org/join.
Hey Luke Cooper, hey Mary Cowdell. It's been a while, how's it going?
I'm good, thanks very much. Me and Mary see each other all the time, so...
Mary, you're well, I hope.
I'm okay.
Okay, so you two have worked together, I know, and written recently about the Strategic Defence Review. Mary, do you want to just tell me what it says?
Yes, the Strategic Defence Review basically commits Britain to increase its defence budget. It commits Britain to, on the basis of NATO, on the assumption that the US is still our main partner, but it allows for a big increase in defence spending, in conventional defence spending, most importantly in nuclear spending, with 15 more submarines and talk of buying American bombers, which will have tactical nuclear weapons. It's entirely focused on conventional weapons. It talks about the European theatre. It talks about the pivot to Indochina, about keeping all our overseas bases. But it says absolutely nothing about other conflicts apart from Ukraine. It doesn't mention Palestine, for example. There's one mention of an airlift to Gaza.
What I would say is that if you're following the news over the last 10 or 15 years, I mean, you might have noticed that Britain has strategic defence reviews a lot. And there's a certain irony in this because they're always presented as grand new strategic planning over 10, 20 or 30 years. And of course, in the last 15 years, the UK has had not one, not two, not three, not four, but this is the fifth strategic defence review. So we've been having them every 3 years. So you would be forgiven for wondering that the British government of whatever iteration can't really decide what it wants to do with its defence sector. And I think one of the problems is that, as Mary said, that there's an enormous amount of things in it. And even though every government comes in and says they want to prioritise XYZ issue, in practice, they tend to still, because I think they're attached to this global Britain idea, they just add a series of other things that are, of course, very costly. And there's this tendency now for the military and defence budget, of course, to go up. And that's really the big headline item from this Labour government, that they've cut development spending in order to grow the defence sector and the military defence budget.
Right, so leading on from that, you use the phrase organised irresponsibility in relation to what this document represents. Can you tell me what that means?
Yes, it's a concept that was developed by the German sociologist Ulrich Beck, who wrote this famous book called Risk Society. And what he meant was that, well, first of all, he said that we live in a world that's globalized and where the threats are no longer the classic threats of an external threat from a foreign aggressor, which is how the state usually used to envisage threats. The state was the Leviathan, which signed a kind of social contract with its citizens to keep it safe. And what it was supposed to keep it safe from was other countries. And in a globalized era, we have all kinds of risks that mostly are man-made, like climate change. And that doesn't work any longer. But the trouble is that states go on behaving as they did in the past. So organized irresponsibility is when you have real problems, but you treat them as though they were old problems and you make things much worse.
That has a lot of resonance with all of politics as soon as you start thinking about it. But moving on from the broadest misconception to two specific misconceptions you describe, the first is that this is written as though the US is still our special ally that we're in this kind of beautiful relationship with. And the second is that it can be relied upon as an ally of Europe in a clash against Putin. Luke, are those two ideas that interconnected? Do they rely on each other?
Yes, and some of the formulations in the Strategic Defence Review, I must say, like took my breath away slightly. So we're in a political moment. You know, it's no exaggeration to say that this is a new moment in world history where the United States appears to be pivoting away from the defence of Europe towards a much closer relationship with Russia. Now, that's very complicated because there's still an enormous amount of institutional cooperation between Britain and the United States and cooperations in their military industrial complexes and their defence sectors. And so, nonetheless, there's this change in politics at the top, with the US appearing to side certainly with many Russian narratives about the war in Ukraine, that it was started by NATO, that it's about the liberation of Russian, allegedly Russian speakers and Russian nationals in eastern and southeastern Ukraine, and that the government in Kiev is a dictatorship and a far-right government and this kind of thing. So we have this big discursive shift that Washington has been undertaking. Now, you would think in the context of that complexity, you might have a strategic defense review that says, well, okay, we need to maybe start to make sure we're cooperating much more closely with Europe and more closely with European defense companies and the European military industrial complex in order to just hedge at the very least against the potential of the US no longer being there for European states. Now, instead of this, the Defence Review really just talks up with some really breathtaking formulations about the enormous potential for expanding industrial and technological collaboration with the United States. So there's no real indication in the document that it's preparing for a new moment. And I want to take this over to you, Mary, to say a bit more about some of the specific details around what the SDR envisages for US and UK defence cooperation, because nuclear weapons plays a big role, right?
Yes, I think that's, to me, that's the most breathtaking thing. I mean, it's really recommitting itself to the Trident submarines. It's suggesting that we have more submarines, 15. It's suggesting that we buy American bombers with tactical nuclear weapons. All of that is going to cost an enormous amount. If we're serious that we want to help Ukraine militarily and that we, you know, if we think about the nature of the Russian threat, then I think it consists of a threat to Ukraine, which is actually a sort of threat to us, because if Ukraine loses, not only will Russia be nearer, but I think it'll end up in a lot of chaos, which will be very bad for the European Union and for us. But also, I think Russia probably is a threat to the frontline states, to the Baltic states, particularly former Soviet states like Moldova. And we need to be able to support that conventionally. I mean, leaving aside that this is a crazy moment to increase nuclear weapons just because the world is a very turbulent place. And, you know, the idea that we're going to legitimize the acquisition of nuclear weapons at a time when we're worrying about Iran, North Korea, whoever, leaving aside all the incredible dangers of nuclear weapons, I mean, this could come to as much as, I mean, the estimates are 30 to 40% of our defense budget. It could come to more. And it's just breathtaking that you would emphasize nuclear weapons rather than conventional weapons at this moment.
So two questions from that, which either of you can take. One of them is that this, it does seem that that slide into committing a huge amount of money into nuclear arsenal is a slide from wishing the world were as it used to be into completely magical thinking. Can you account for that? Do you get the sense that there are kind of dissenting voices in government or beyond? I mean, what is going on?
I'm sure there are dissenting voices inside government, or at least, you know, at the level of the civil service. I think what kind of happened is that the Labour government was so committed to winning, they really didn't give, I think this affects things across the board, they really didn't give any thought to what they were going to do. And I think they've been really beholden to the civil service. And so I think this is a Ministry of Defence document, basically. I think Labour, it hasn't really given any instructions. It's just asked the Ministry of Defence, and it's what all the things the Ministry of Defence would love to have. I mean, one issue relating to the defence review, which Luke didn't mention, is that some of these past reviews have not been defence reviews, but security reviews. And security reviews are usually broader. They say, what are the threats to British security? So they do talk about climate change. They do talk about conflicts in other places. They talk about pandemics. They're apparently going to do a security review, which will come out soon. But it's very odd to do the defence review, which is what do our defence forces need, before you do the security review.
Right. And Luke, I mean, how do you account for the fact that we don't seem to be able to let go of this idea of ourselves as in a special relationship with America? Do you think there's any logical process behind it? Or do you just think it's a kind of collective emotional unwillingness to let go?
I think there's two ways of looking at it. The first would be as a political messaging exercise. And I think that's probably how most, especially most people like us who don't like Trump and are on the left of politics, look at Keir Starmer's engagement with him with some level of being, you know, completely gobsmacked that it could be so slavishly in cahoots in some ways with this American government. So that's a factor in the performance and the messaging. Probably for some voters, it might look like good statesmanship, but I think for a lot of voters, it looks very opportunistic. But I think the other second factor in terms of rationale is this very intense and quite well integrated military-industrial relationship that the UK has with the United States. So if you take the biggest British defence producer, British Aerospace, just under 50% of their sales every year go to the American market. When we talk about markets in defence, we're just talking about the American government pretty much. You know, there aren't real markets, it's markets of handfuls of buyers. And so getting out of that for British Aerospace would be challenging. I think if you were a government that was thinking really strategically about the next 20 years and you're from the Labour side of politics, you'd probably be saying, well, look, there's a risk here to British Aerospace. It's going to have to look to become less dependent on the American market. It's going to have to look to Europe. That's okay, because Europe is increasing its defence spending as well. So we will need closer collaboration with European countries. And you would probably also say that if there is going to be increased defence spending, then why should it flow? Why should the benefits of it flow to shareholders in British Aerospace? Shouldn't it be nationalised, or at least the UK government should take a stake in it to ensure that some of those profits come back to the British taxpayer, which will, of course, be buying a lot of the company's products. So, you know, in defence production, there's always a logic of state ownership and control in that sense, because there's so few buyers for the goods anyway.
Yeah, I just want to square off a little bit of the evidence base for the arguments. So what was the writing on the wall for the US no longer being our ally and the US no longer being Europe's protector? I mean, was it these kind of big signature moments like J.D. Vance's speech in Munich, or was it obvious quite a long time before then? Mary?
Well, I think it was probably obvious in the first Trump administration. I wanted to add one other point to what Luke was saying, which is also about big, expensive platforms. I mean, that's what we did in the Cold War. Basically, defence spending centred on naval ships, especially carriers, aircraft, and tanks. They were the sort of, in a way, the Fordist methods of warfare. And even then, people like me were saying, look, these have got more and more expensive and more complicated, so you won't even want to risk them in war. And now with the Ukraine war, it's become clear that those big, expensive platforms are incredibly vulnerable. And as the Ukrainians say, conventional war nowadays is about people and drones and missiles. And yet the Strategic Defence Review, not only all these other things we've said, it's going to buy more tanks, more carriers, more aircraft. It's just, again, another mind-blowing example of the Strategic Defence Review.
You also say in your blog that we could already be in World War III, and I've heard Fiona Hill say the same thing, but it won't look anything like World War I or World War II. Can you describe for me first in what respects it won't look the same, and then how we know we're in it if it doesn't resemble what we knew?
I don't know whether World War III is the right word, but I sometimes say we're in a global new war. New wars are what I talk about in happening in places like Yemen, Sudan, Myanmar, and their wars, which are really very chaotic with lots of different violent groups. And I think what I'm really saying by saying we are in a war is that there is an attack on democracy going on. And that's how I understand new wars. New wars always start with democratic protests, and they're ways of diverting democracy, suppressing democracy. And that's a very important way to understand them. And I think what's happening now is that it's in the interests of the new oligarchic or not so new oligarchic regimes all around the world to create a situation that's favourable to extraction and transactionalism. And that situation is chaos and instability. And that's what I think the moment we really do face a threat from the far right in Europe. And I think it's something that's being supported both by the Trump administration and by Putin. And we should be deeply concerned about that, because if the far right succeed all over Europe, we will have a long-term, chaotic, unstable, autocratic situation that could be really frightening. And we're on that trajectory. And so thinking about that is so much of a priority. And one of the big problems of the SDR is it kind of mentions hybrid threats, mostly in relation to cybersecurity, but it doesn't recognize that there are incredible trade-offs between defense and doing the sorts of things that people really want who are likely to vote for the far right. I mean, we see it in Britain. Is Rachel Reeves really going to cut welfare in order to fund defence? And is that going to really play into reform? It's as direct as that. And precisely because they're, you know, they're still sticking to the fiscal rules. I mean, not only here at home, but already they've done an enormous cut to foreign aid. And that's kind of disastrous in many of the new war situations we face. And it's not as though those conflicts don't matter. They do matter. They affect us through migration. They affect us through extremist ideology. They affect us through transnational crime.
Luke, describe what hybrid warfare means for us.
Yeah, sure. So it's terminology that's become fashionable in recent years, and it's associated with a conflict that doesn't take on a conventional character where hostile states engage in different forms of warfare, like information warfare, information suppression, with the view of changing the behavior in some ways or of the other side, or creating some kind of chaotic environment that advantages the state that's conducting the hybrid warfare and disadvantages the state that is the target of it. And this is associated with the Russian side. I mean, Mary, many years ago, drew my attention to General Gerasimov's concept of political technologies. So the use of political forms of intervention to conduct conflict and a form of hybrid warfare overseas. So things like disinformation, use of strategic technologies, new technologies, the digital landscape, social media, all of these kinds of things.
Yeah, he talked about non-linear war and said that it's very easy to reduce a country to chaos through a combination of political technology, supporting dissidents. And that was really their strategy towards Ukraine before they started on a conventional strategy.
So I've got three follow-ups to that. The first is that the strategy, it sounds like, is not about full frontal attack on a state, but creating such discord within that state that you effectively set it at war against each other. Is that right? They're kind of creating civil...
Absolutely right.
Right. So if we were doing a kind of hybrid military counter-strategy, would that not start with rebuilding unity in a bordered way? I mean, which is to say, you know, do we have to come back together in our own political discourse before we could fight an external, or can we not come back together until the external has been identified?
I think you put it really beautifully in your first version. This is the funny thing. I think sometimes people like us are accused of being terribly utopian and pacifistic in our mentalities and things like this. But we're just being pragmatic. I mean, what do you expect to happen to conflicts in the world if you destroy the development aid budget? And it's not just Britain doing this. Of course, the United States has done it. I'm afraid France is also making cuts, Germany making cuts. So you add all of that together, you're talking about the real decimation of humanitarian aid, aid that we frankly owe many states in the global south because of they're still recovering from the legacies of colonialism. Of course, if you cut that off, you're going to get more conflict, more insecurity. And likewise, as you say, with hybrid warfare, if you build less inclusive societies that aren't able to support its citizens through strong public infrastructure and healthcare and education, keep inequality in check and have decent lives for many people, then of course you're going to be more vulnerable to people like Putin and their, you know, troll factories on social media selling discord and dissent and division. So we're trying to be pragmatic here. And, you know, you don't really resist if your concept, as Mary says, is, you know, that we need to fight Putin with an enormous aircraft carrier cruising around the Indo-Pacific or something. You know, that really doesn't cut it when it comes to the actual threats that we do face.
One more follow-up, but this was sort of, particularly in supporting dissidents and arming dissidents, this was the Americans' policy with the earliest days of the CIA and nascent communist states, and it never worked. How come it's working so well now for the right?
Well, is it working that well? I mean, from our perspective, it's working. But I think the Russians actually did think, when they wrote Nonlinear War, that this is what the West was doing. They were very conscious of... Do you remember the color revolutions? Well, so the democratic revolutions in places like Ukraine and Georgia were all called orange revolutions, or I can't remember what the color was. or in Serbia that overthrew dictatorships. And the Russian view was that these, well, they did all get all these NGOs and human rights groups got money from the US and from George Soros. And so he felt this was a deliberate effort by the West, that this was how they interpreted. It was a deliberate effort by the West to undermine states like Ukraine and Georgia, which were happily within the Russian sphere of influence. I mean, that's their mirror image view. They think they're just doing to us what we did to them.
Right. Okay. But I mean, I'm still struck by how much faster and more effective they've been in sort of denaturing mature democracies. And I mean, arguably, they were pushing an open door, right?
Yeah, I think that's the point, isn't it? Like, so Brexit was not caused by Russia. Trump was not caused by Russia. But clearly, in both those information contexts, Russia was active and was pretty gleeful about the results. So a divided West, a large state in the corner of northwestern Europe, you know, maybe we overemphasize our importance sometimes, but nonetheless, you know, leaving the European Union was a blow to the European Union as much as it was a blow to us. So in that sense, I think it was a victory for Putin in a strategic way. But I think Mayor is right, of course, to sound a note of caution here, especially if you look at Ukraine. I mean, the story of Ukraine after the full-scale invasion, February 2022, is massive unity against Russia, including amongst the Ukrainians that speak Russian as a first language, and including amongst political forces that had traditionally supported a close relationship with Russia. When the full-scale invasion happened, they were like, oh my God, what has happened here? Of course, we will resist and defend our country. So the information side of the Russian invasion of Ukraine was a catastrophe for genuine Russian influence in the country.
Okay, it seems premature because we certainly haven't headed off the threat of Putin's Russia. But can we talk about the pivot towards the Indo-Pacific, what countries that actually means and what the agenda was there historically and how this SDR kind of stays on those trammels?
This is probably one of the most ludicrous bits of the document, Mary, no?
Absolutely.
So Britain has these flotillas that it has in the surround its two large aircraft carriers that, you know, have had various hiccups and problems. They're very expensive bits of military hardware, and it's been sailing them around the Indo-Pacific in order to support the idea that the UK would play some kind of security role within the region in the event of Chinese aggression towards other states. And then the other side of it is this ARCOS arrangement. So this refers to a UK, Australia, US submarine production agreement. And that's a proposal to further expand the UK's submarine capacity in alliance with those two other states. And it's the idea that therefore this makes the UK a kind of strategic power in the Asian theatre, if you like.
And that is yesterday, that is for the birds, is it? That's neither relevant to today nor executable.
I think that if you're talking about the UK prioritising where it can make a difference and where it has an important role to play, I think there are probably two areas. One is protection against Russia holistically, so as in the ways that we've been describing. So that means building inclusive societies as well as supporting conventional defence. And the other is addressing violent conflict that Mary talked about right at the beginning. And that's an area where the UK has played a pretty decent role, hasn't always got it right, but nonetheless has invested a lot in conflict resolution and supporting humanitarian development that can mitigate violent conflicts. And that's completely absent in the Strategic Defence Review. Now, the idea that the UK is really going to deter China in Asia just seems, as you say, a bit for the birds. But of course, if China did invade Taiwan, that would be a disastrous moment for the entire world. And would be in a completely new situation. But the UK having an aircraft carrier cruising around the Indo-Pacific is not going to be decisive one way or another if China chooses to make such a terrible reactionary and foolish decision.
Mary, you talk about all the countries which are sacrificed on the altar of fighting yesterday's fires, either the nations which are not mentioned, Myanmar, Sudan, Somalia, or the nations which are mentioned, but so insufficiently as to make that kind of embarrassing, and that would be Palestine, Syria, and Yemen. Can you talk a bit more about these blind spots and what risks they pose for the future, not just of our defence strategy, but of the international order?
Yes. I'm not sure whether it's blind spots or whether it's because they're focusing on defence, and that maybe when we see the security review that's coming out soon, these will be mentioned, because certainly as far as David Lammy is concerned and the Foreign Office, they've said their priorities are Sudan, Syria and Ukraine. So it's still there in the Foreign Office's priority, but not in the Ministry of Defence's priorities. And that just suggests to me that there's no joined up thinking in the UK government, that people aren't linking and they don't see the kind of direct... I mean, also what is extraordinary is that all of these wars are wars in which the main tactic is forced displacement. How can we be not doing something about forced displacement when we've got this ridiculous anti-immigration policy?
And is that a conversation that isn't happening across Europe? Do you think the EU is not talking about forced displacement enough?
No, absolutely. I mean, there needs to be a conversation about how all of these issues, extreme poverty, inequality, and particularly conflict, is... I mean, we've seen in the last 2 years, we decided to accept people from Hong Kong and Ukraine, but not, weirdly, from Palestine. And that hugely contributed to our numbers, but we ought to be.
Just to linger on that for a second, because I've really found it noticeable in public life and public discourse, that there does seem to be a nakedly racist agenda that Palestinian lives don't count for as much. And you see that in discussions about the death toll. You see that in discussions about the kind of language used about families that are killed. You see that in our policy on who's granted asylum and who isn't. You see that in so many ways. And I wonder about the kind of long-term toxicity of that.
It is completely shocking, but is it racism or is it because of this? Well, it is racism in the sense that I feel Israel is fighting a colonial war, and it's what we did during empire. But at the same time, it's this absolute obsession with doing what America does, I think. And that's why we go on supporting Israel when it's quite clearly engaged in a genocide. And what is really more shocking, is that I do think the ICJ decision on genocide brought by South Africa and the ICC indictments are a huge breakthrough for international justice, which is really an important element of dealing with these kinds of wars. And we've shown ourselves, by not respecting those judgments, we've really shown ourselves to have double standards. We talk about a rules-based order, but we're not prepared to accept the ICJ decision.
Luke, do you think the tide is turning on that, though? I mean, I see it turning in Europe. Do you think it's turning in British politics?
I certainly hope so. I think the point that Mary made around this geopolitical block-based thinking is really central to it. And I think that in some ways, the tragedy of it is that the actions of Western states, I mean, I don't really like the generalization Western states in this context, because we have to point out it's not all Western states. I mean, Ireland is a Western state, but definitely doesn't have the same line. But I think the tragedy of it is that it really sort of reinforces that geopolitical mentality in the rest of the world in a way that's really bad for supporters of Ukraine's struggle for democracy and freedom, because it makes it much harder for them to make their case in the global south amongst countries that have traditionally supported the Palestinian freedom struggle for human rights and dignity. So the sadness of it is that it reinforces this division of the world, or this imagined division of the world, because I think it's much more complicated than the narrative suggests. But nonetheless, this idea that there's a West, that there's a China-led world, that there's the global South, and that these are hard blocks that are hardening with different interests. And so while I fully agree, and I hope you're correct, Mary, that the ICJ cases and the ICC criminal prosecutions are moments of breakthrough for a genuine universalism and accountability and an end to impunity, you know, one would have to say at the moment that's looking optimistic, because for that ICC judgment to really be implemented, it needs the support of some of the wealthiest and states in the world, and particularly in Europe, to get really behind it in a full throttled way. And at the moment, they don't want to criticize it, because they still want to maintain a support, a kind of passive support, if you like, for international criminal law. But they haven't really mobilized the power that they have at their disposal behind enforcing those indictments. And in the absence of doing that, you would have to say that this won't end well for international law.
Well, of course, I agree with that. I'm not saying...
Oh, no, I wasn't really disagreeing.
I'm just saying it's a potential turning point, which if we built on...
Absolutely.
...could be really important. And I think one of the things that's most fascinating about the changes that have come about in recent years is that if you look at Ukraine and Palestine, they both the most documented wars there have ever been. You know, NGOs, ordinary people have been busy documenting war crimes like mad in both those countries. So there's a huge amount of evidence if ever we wanted to undertake prosecutions.
And I hope the tide is turning in Europe. I think in the UK it's a funny environment again, like politically, because public opinion has always been, perhaps surprisingly, really quite pro-Palestinian. I mean, even at the very beginning of the Israeli war on Gaza, after the massacres of the 7th of October, UK public opinion responded very clearly in the polling then that, while of course what happened on the 7th of October the majority of people clearly felt was wrong, at the same time it didn't justify the collective punishment of the Palestinian people. So it's the political class that has got to catch up with the general public. And I think it's not quite the same situation in the United States. There is more popular, if you like, support for Israel. But nonetheless, the trend is the same in the United States, and the trend of the political class being out of kilter with the public, I think, is there too as well.
Yeah, it's really marked. It's getting more and more marked, I think. Bernie Sanders was talking about how far the lawmakers were from mass popular opinion, and it just made you realise that the same was true in the UK, I think. Anyway, finally, I want to talk about the trade-offs, because obviously, however we get to 3.5% of GDP on defence, it's going to come from somewhere, if to remain within the fiscal whatevers. What departments do you foresee being the big losers from this? What do you think the social impacts of that will be? How does one lodge a significant objection to that?
Well, the department that is the big loser, because we've had the spending review, of course, following up after the strategic defence review, is the FCDO. And their budget is anticipated to fall by more than 7% this year. The reason for that is not cuts primarily to diplomatic staff and that suite of work that the FCDO does, is through that real attack on humanitarian aid budget that we've been talking about. I think the more wider point here, the trade-offs, or so-called trade-offs, have been constructed by the fiscal rules and by a lack of willingness to raise taxes. And fundamentally, to get the UK out of its broken economy and to fix its public services and public infrastructure, we're going to have to ask the wealthy and the rich to pay a lot more than they do at the moment. And we are also, I think, going to have to say, and this is something that Another Europe has been beating its drum on for many, many years, we're going to have to say that this stupid Brexit arrangement that we have is unsustainable for a healthy British economy, and we need at the very minimum to move back towards the single market. And I think that's, if you're talking about a trade-off with capital here, that's the trade-off. So to capital, you say, yes, you're going to be taxed more to invest in the green transition, defence industries and our public services, but we're going to restore your access to the single market.
I agree with all that completely, but I'd like to add one more point, is that we're in a ridiculous situation where we're subject to the whims of financial markets. And actually, it's really, really hard nowadays to make decisions at a national level. And what's more, we keep being told that if we do tax the rich, it won't come to much. Why? Because they can put all their money in different countries. And so being part of the European Union is really important in influencing the global context. I mean, the world, we're not the only country in this situation. It's far worse. We're experiencing what many developing countries experienced under the impact of neoliberal rules of conditionality. And what we need is a new global set of rules. We need to have a financial transaction tax to reduce speculation from financial markets. We need to have a global wealth tax. I mean, so that we're not stuck with these ridiculous fiscal rules. So I think that requires a very, very different mindset from the sort of national, Western, myopic mindset expressed in the SDR.
Leading on from that, just quickly, what do you foresee the impact being on our welfare state, our social security system and our public services, with just this kind of orientation towards defence? And that would hold across Europe. I mean, people are talking about getting up to 5% of GDP.
Yeah, they are, though they do mean that 1.5% is allowed to be on infrastructure. But yeah, of course. But all I'm trying to say is, of course, I mean, the main trade-off is on our welfare system, and we desperately need to pay more. And we need both to tax the wealth, but more importantly, we really need a new global compact so that we have a genuine global redistribution, which affects the whole way we think about our foreign policy.
That's such an important point. I mean, we should do a podcast about it, maybe, the history of finance and neoliberalism. I mean, one thing that I've been thinking about recently is part of the story that we tell about neoliberalism is sometimes a bit too political, because we talk about the reforms that Thatcher introduced or that Reagan introduced or Tony Blair or the Third Way in Europe and this kind of thing as a part of and parcel of the neoliberal story. But the more challenging way of telling the story is that after the Second World War, there's finance, capital and financialization had this enormous capacity, regardless of who was in power and what laws they were passing, to innovate in response to those laws and to get around them. And that's why, as you say, Mary, the focus on the global is crucial to address that problem of excessive financialization. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Another Europe podcast. You can support the pod by leaving a review or rating wherever you get your podcasts. And you can join the Another Europe family with regular events just for members by going to anothereurope.org/join and signing up. See you next time.